4 months. We've had Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Israel, and the Ansarullah in Yemen with their supersonic missile, or whatever it's called, the big-time missile that went right into Israel undetected from Yemen. They've all been broadcasting, showcasing their technical capabilities. In other words, sending a message to the other that we want to avoid a full war because we have huge capabilities that we haven't used yet, and this is something you all want to avoid. Israel just did its part in that drama, showing the capabilities that it has. The thing that is fascinating to me and important and still unclear is that Israel had to prepare for this months and months ahead of time. And we'll get more details on that soon. But this suggests that this kind of an operation was probably the prelude to a big land and air attack, I'm assuming. But because they wouldn't just do this by itself and drop it, probably. But we'll see. We don't know the details. But the Israelis have talked about Hezbollah for several years as their main threat, their main concern in the region. Hamas and others are secondary. They see Hezbollah both as a threat because of its power and its disruption in the north of Israel, and because of its very direct links with Iran. And they've talked about trying to break it up, destroy it, push it back from the border. They keep coming up with all kinds of different ideas, none of which are clear, and almost none of which are within its capabilities. So there's so many unknown factors, but we can say that all sides have tremendous capabilities, technological and other. They're prepared to use them. They're prepared to risk an all-out war in the region, which they would try to contain in the region without getting, say, the U.S. and Iran involved. And we don't know if this is all, if the Israelis did this mainly to put pressure on the Lebanese and Hezbollah to accept the Israeli terms for the new terms of engagement, which is to push Hezbollah back from the Lebanon-Israel border about 10 miles or so. It's possible that this is just a short-term measure that Israel is trying to achieve. So I think we have to take all of these things into consideration. The last point I make is nothing that happened yesterday and today or in the last few months is really new. But the scale of it is much bigger than anything that's happened before. Israel and Hezbollah and others have used technology to kill each other and terrorize each other for decades. Terrorizing civilians is a stable Israeli policy for many years. None of it is really new, but the scale of it now is what's kind of scary. And because the Israel-U.S. combination is now actively exchanging fire with five or six parties all around the Middle East and facing a huge global swell of support for a ceasefire in Gaza and for a Palestinian state, serious political pressures that might even influence the American presidential election outcome, possibly in the swing states. These are signs that the scale of the actions and the scale of the consequences are far higher than ever before. And if you take it, you say, why is this? I would say this: the one main reason. There are many, but the one main reason is that the U.S. and the Western world has allowed the right-wing Israeli governments of the last 15, 20 years to do anything they want in terms of settlements, imprisoning thousands of Palestinians, killing people, now a plausible genocide. Israel can do anything it wants, kill as many people, ignore as many laws, terrorize as many people as it wants, dehumanize as many people as it wants. It will suffer no consequences. This is something quite extraordinary, and the world has to somehow come to grips with this.
I wanted to go back to Beirut for a moment. Victims of Israel's pager attack included, I guess she's 10 years old, a little girl named Fatima Jaffer Abdullah, killed when her father's pager exploded. And now, also confirmed, a young boy named Bilal Khanj has not survived his injuries after the Israeli pager attack in Lebanon. He becomes the second child to be killed. And I wanted to go back to the journalist Mohammed Klait to ask about how widespread these pagers are in Lebanon and about the use of pagers specifically to avoid Israel's surveillance of specifically cell phones.
Okay, so there are two catches in this. The first part is that this new batch that Hezbollah has ordered for these pagers, as you have mentioned before, that it's a Taiwanese-made pager, but they got it from a Bulgarian company that uses the same name of the Taiwanese company or has the rights to use the name. As the investigations or journalistic right. investigations have shown that Israel has intercepted this cargo of around 4,000 to 5,000 pagers, and they have tampered with it and detonated them alongside placing eavesdropping devices inside of them. And as Dr. Khoury has mentioned, that it was a weapon that they wanted to use during a full-on scale attack or maybe a land attack on Lebanon. But as we have seen 2 days ago, this plot was exposed by certain technicians in Hezbollah. And you know, my personal sources have said that because this plot was exposed and they were working on getting rid of them and during an investigation that they were doing on these pages, that's why Israel has detonated these pages in a sudden way and caused this chain attack on people and on civilians and military personnel of Hezbollah. And
Mohammed, just a quick correction. It was a Budapest-based, it was a Hungary-based company. I'm looking at the Reuters report. The model of pagers
used in detonations in Lebanon
were made by a Budapest-based BAC Back Consulting.
Yes, yes.
The Taiwanese pager firm Gold Apollo said on Wednesday, adding it had only licensed out its brand to the company and was not involved in the production of the devices. But keep going, Mohammed.
Yes, I'm sorry. I think I said Bulgaria, not Budapest. Yeah, and as for the second part, why do they still use the pagers? Hezbollah's General Secretary Hassan Nasrallah has said before that there's a huge danger in using cell phones, that smartphones that are connected to the Wi-Fi and to the global internet, on the safety of the combatants of Hezbollah in the south, as well as the civilian usage of these phones when they are filming in videos the locations of where the missiles and the rockets are coming out and in the fields and in the valleys and so on, because this is when it's being spread on social media or being distributed and shared on WhatsApp or other applications, this is giving intelligence information for the Israelis, whom are later on bombing these locations of the videos that are being widespread. So there were internal orders by Hezbollah to not use smartphones, to try to disconnect them when possible from the internet and from the Wi-Fi connections. So they have relied on these, on this new batch of pagers that they had. But as I've mentioned, that they were tampered with and intercepted and tampered with by the Israeli Mossad. And we saw what happened yesterday.
And are people still going to hospitals to give blood?
And I just wanted to add something for what Mr. Kais has said concerning that Israel is using booby traps, which are illegal based on international law. That during the 90s, I still remember when we used to go to the south during the Israeli occupation of the southern Lebanon, Israel used to drop baby toys that were booby traps, and they have small explosive devices. They used to drop them from military helicopters. helicopters in the valleys, on the streets of the villages where little kids were used to pick them up, and then they would explode. That's why we have seen many people from my generation, from the 90s, that they are either arms are amputated or they are missing a leg because of this illegal usage or illegal forms of warfare.
And the hospital, the issue of the hospitals and people going to give blood. Again, thousands and thousands of people have been injured, nearly 3,000, it's believed at this point, Mohammed.
Yes, and as I've mentioned earlier, that these pagers are used by medical personnel, logistics, some of the military personnel of Hezbollah. I know some of the persons that I talked to yesterday that they were at a clinic, and two of the doctors had these pagers, and they blew up on their waist. One of them had his fingers amputated; the other had minor injuries. And we've seen this huge influx of people trying to donate blood because as the Ministry of Health has said, there are roughly 2,800 persons who were injured, as I've mentioned as well, 1,850 only in Beirut. The huge state of chaos, or medical chaos, that we have seen in the city, particularly, is out of this world. It's sort of like something from a sci-fi movie. But we have seen this huge state of cohesion and support from Lebanese in general. That they have went from, they came from different parts of the country, from far sides of the country, just to donate blood. Doctors and nurses came from bordering areas to the city and to Baalbek in the east, and also to Nabatiya and Tyre in the south, to support the hospitals because they had a shortage of medical staff. And also to donate blood for the people who were injured, creating these blood banks in the streets, as we have also are seeing today, because it's a huge case of chaos, and sadly we don't have the proper medical infrastructure because of the crises that we have been through since 2019, and there's no proper plan of emergency to be implemented by the government. So people are trying to organize themselves in order to ease the crisis that we are in right now.
Well, Mohammed Kleita, I want to thank you so much for being with us, joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, Lebanese journalist. Ramzi Kais, Human Rights Watch researcher, thank you as well for joining us from Geneva, investigating human rights abuses in Lebanon. And Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, speaking to us from Boston, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut. Of course, we'll continue to follow this story. Coming up, ProPublica has revealed at least two black women died in Georgia after they could not access legal abortion and timely medical care. Vice President Harris brought up their stories while addressing the National Association of Black Journalists yesterday. We'll speak with a ProPublica editor working on the story and a Georgia reproductive justice activist with Sister Song. Stay with us. Thank you. Andre Haj, Lebanese musician and ensemble. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at reproductive rights in the United States, which are a key issue in this presidential election now less than 50 days away. On Tuesday, Republican senators once again blocked legislation to protect access to IVF, in vitro fertilization, and require health insurers to cover the fertility treatment after Democrats forced a vote. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris slammed Donald Trump, her Republican rival, for his role in abolishing national abortion rights after he appointed three of the Supreme Court justices who issued the Dobbs ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. In an interview yesterday with the National Association of Black Journalists in Philadelphia, Vice President Harris cited the case reported by ProPublica of Amber Thurman, a 28-year-old black woman in Georgia who died from a fatal infection after doctors refused to treat a rare complication from a medication abortion.
I don't know if anyone here has heard most recently the stories out of Georgia. A tragic story about a young woman who died because it appears the people who should have given her health care were afraid they'd be criminalized after the Dobbs decision came down. Laws that make no exception even for rape or incest, which means that you're telling a survivor of a crime of a violation to their body that they have no right to make a decision about what happens to their body next, which is immoral. An approach that doesn't take into account that most people, I think, agree you don't have to abandon your faith or deeply held beliefs to agree the government should not be telling her what to do with her body.
Georgia's Maternal Mortality Review Committee found Amber Thurman's death was preventable and largely due to delays in care. This comes as Project 2025 staffer, former Trump White House personnel chief John McEntee, doubted the danger of abortion bans in a TikTok post last Thursday.
Can someone track down the women Kamala Harris says are bleeding out in parking lots because Roe v. Wade was overturned? Don't hold your breath.
McEntee was widely ridiculed as women posted responses about their experiences being denied care. Well, today, ProPublica published a new report on a second woman in Georgia who died from medical abortion complications. Candy Miller's family said she didn't visit a doctor, quote, due to the current legislation on pregnancies and abortions, unquote. Overall, deaths due to complications from abortion pills are extremely rare. For more, we're joined by two guests. Monica Simpson is with us. She's executive director of Sister Song, the National Woman of Color Reproductive Justice Collective based in Georgia. And Ziva Brandstetter is also joining us from Walnut Creek, California, senior editor at ProPublica, who helped edit two new reports by Kavitha Serrana. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Ziva. Vice President Harris cited your investigation in her answers to questions from the National Association of Black Journalists yesterday. Can you lay out the stories of Amanda Thurman, and also today you just broke a new story on the second death?
Correct. Well, thank you, first of all, Democracy Now!, for having me on to talk about the reporting by ProPublica and reporter Kavitha Serrana. We have reported two stories. Both deaths of these women occurred in the months following the overturn of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. Both were in Georgia. Both were African-American women. The first case, Amber Thurman, 28-year-old single mother with a 3-year-old son. She died after doctors did not provide care over about a 20-hour period in the emergency room. She had taken abortion medication to end her pregnancy, and fetal tissue remained, which is a rare a very rare complication of taking abortion medication, very simply solved with a procedure called a DNC that doctors did not provide over 20 hours in the emergency room. That procedure in almost all cases in Georgia now and in other abortion ban states is a felony. Doctors could face criminal prosecution for performing it. We don't know what was going through their minds, but they did not operate over 20 hours, and she died in August of 2022. The story that we just published today on ProPublica's website is about Candy Miller, a 41-year-old woman, also from Georgia, mother of three, who also self-managed her abortion at home, which is becoming far more regular under abortion bans. She took abortion medication, again, rare complication. Instead of going to the hospital, she was afraid to seek care and did not, and died at home with a mixture of drugs that her family believes was trying to manage the pain. And she died as well in November of 2022. That death has been ruled by the state preventable. And not only that, directly related to the state's abortion ban, which is the first time we've seen this reported.
And explain the abortion ban in Georgia.
Correct. It's a 6-week ban. We classify that almost the same as a complete ban, because many people who can become pregnant don't know at that point that they are even pregnant. And experts say a 6-week ban is tantamount to a complete ban. And there are no health exceptions in Georgia's ban. Well, Candy Miller had lupus. She had hypertension. She had diabetes. She's 41 years old. She already has three children. She found herself pregnant. Doctors had told her, your body cannot survive another pregnancy. It will kill you. So she had literally no good options under a Georgia's abortion ban.
Now, can you talk about how rare medication abortion complications are, Ziva?
About 6 million people since the FDA approved have used it, and there have been 31 deaths of any kind, only 11 of those from sepsis. It is 0.0005% of cases that are fatal, which is a lower complication rate than penicillin and Viagra. And so it's extremely safe. All medications have risk. There is a simple solution to a complication with abortion medication, and that is a DNC. And abortion ban states, for the vast majority of cases, criminalize that procedure. Mm.
I want to turn to Monica Simpson. You're executive director of the Georgia organization Sister Song. Can you talk about the levels of Black maternal mortality in Georgia?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me this morning. We are devastated to hear this news and to see that Black women are still not being treated in the ways that they need to by our healthcare system in Georgia. What is real in the state of Georgia is that we are in a maternal health care crisis in our state. We are a state that has yet to expand Medicaid, which means that thousands upon thousands of people are already falling under the radar and not getting access to the care that they need. And on top of that, we are dealing with the fact that we are in this country seeing Black women die at a rate 3 to 4 times higher than white women in childbirth, right? So we look at that and coupled with the fact that Georgia has a desert of OBGYN availability in our state, there are over half of our states that do not, excuse me, half of our counties that do not have access to an OBGYN. So people are having to travel miles upon miles just to get care. So when you bring all of that together in this context of a state that is also dealing with a 6-week abortion ban, Sister Song is the lead plaintiff in that case against our state. We have been fighting that for many years now, trying to get this ban removed. We are seeing a really dire picture for Black women and for people in general in the state of Georgia.
In this case that ProPublica talked about today, the story of Candy Miller. Monica, Candy Miller's health was so fragile. I'm reading the first sentences. Candy Miller's health was so fragile, doctors warned having another baby could kill her. So she was already at high risk. Her previous pregnancy was high risk, but she was terrified to go to the doctor. Talk about that, what this means, and the number of women who may be suffering or have died that we don't know. It's because of their fear of going to the doctor that they would be criminalized.
Absolutely. We hear this story far too often, that we know too many Black women in particular right, are saying that they do not feel safe when they go to their doctor. They don't feel as if they're listened to. They don't feel as if they're trusted. We have seen this with, this show up in the lives of people who are celebrities like Serena Williams, right? So if we have people who have the amount of privilege and resources that Serena Williams has, and they are still not listened to and trusted by healthcare providers, imagine what that looks like on the ground for everyday people who are trying to get access to care. In our membership, we get these stories all the time that we don't feel like we're trusted. We don't feel like we're going to get access to the information that we want. And so it silences people. And we know that that silence then drives people inward, and it does not allow them to be able to move towards the solutions that they need for themselves and their families. So this is a really sad day in the state of Georgia. Our elected officials need to be on top of this more than ever. And we have to take this very seriously, because we knew, and we have been saying since the Dobbs decision and even before this, that when you remove access, restrict access, ban access to life-saving care, health care that people need, then those who have historically been pushed to the margins will be the ones most affected. And we are seeing that in the state of Georgia, where these Black women have lost their lives to a preventable issue that could have been taken care of in real time.
At the Democratic convention, a ceremony roll call to nominate Kamala Harris as president included Kate Cox speaking for Texas. She'd spoken out after she was forced to flee Texas to get abortion care after learning her pregnancy was not viable. She was introduced by former Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards, who had an op-ed in the New York Times this weekend headlined, "Harris is good on abortion rights. Now she needs to take it to 11. Other featured speakers included three other women impacted by abortion bans: Hadley Duvall of Kentucky, Amanda Zarofsky of Texas, Caitlin Joshua of Louisiana. This is Caitlin Joshua.
2 years ago, my husband and I were expecting our second child. Our daughter, Lauren, couldn't wait to be a big sister. I was getting ready for her fourth birthday party when something didn't feel right. Two emergency rooms sent me away. Because of Louisiana's abortion ban, no one would confirm that I was miscarrying. I was in pain, bleeding so much my husband feared for my life. No woman should experience what I endured, but too many have. They write to me saying, what happened to you happened to me. Sometimes they're miscarrying, scared to tell anyone, even their doctors. Our daughters deserve better. America deserves better.
Caitlin Joshua is an African-American woman. Ziva, you mention her case in both your ProPublica articles.
Yes. Well, obviously, as has been noted by your other guests, the burden of this issue falls heaviest on Black women and women of color. I think it's very interesting to note that there have been literally dozens of cases like hers across the country where women have had to rush across state lines, have been denied care. There are now two confirmed deaths in an abortion ban state that have been ruled preventable by an official committee, including 10 doctors. Both are Black women. I don't think it's an accident that we're seeing this pattern. I think there are more cases out there. ProPublica is certainly interested in hearing from people whose loved ones may have died, who have questions about how they died, and we are going to keep looking into them.
I wanted to give Monica Simpson the last word. Cecile Richards had spoken at the DNC. She actually is suffering from brain cancer right now. And in this op-ed piece she just wrote for The Times, her headline, "Harris is good on abortion rights. Now she needs to take it to 11. Do you agree with this?
I do think that we are in a time where we have to not just look at where we are. We have to think about where we want to go, right? And what we have been saying for many, many years is that we know that a federal right to abortion is necessary, but access is even more imperative. And so when we think about the state of where we are in this country, knowing that we don't have the federal right and we were already suffering from lack of access to abortion care, we have to think about this at the next level. How do we make sure that we're not only creating the opportunities for legislation that creates a federal right to be achieved, but that we are expanding access?
We have to leave it there. Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song, and Ziva Branstetter, editor at ProPublica. We'll link to both your pieces. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Rogan and Blabley present Twisted Scripture.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby.
Hours of fun distorting, warping, and perverting your favorite scriptures, which you can wield against Satan's apostates as well as your own friends and family. Bible not included. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.